am I? And what am I anyway? If we are to fulfill the mission of faultless prophets, we must face this question candidly. Just what sort of people are we? Who are we? And what are we anyway? On the face of it, we are a nation that has gathered itself by its own bootstraps from the sea level of the jungle to the amazing elevation of unparalleled order, beauty, and power. On the face of it, we are a nation the dominating force of whose character has for centuries been the frontier motif. Aggressive and progressive change. Ceaseless, restless, disturbing change. On the face of it, we are a nation which has seemed to jut above the tableland of world morality as a massive peak. On the face of it, we are a nation that, in words at least, has kept the flame of freedom burning within the breast of the lowliest child of this earth. On the face of it, we are a nation whose torturous struggles toward articulation of this freedom have involved us in a maze of paradoxes. But on the face of it, we are a nation that has nevertheless stolidly maintained its determination to replace uncertainty by certainty, vagueness by definiteness, and confusion by order. On the face of it, this is what we are. But as we closet ourselves with the quiet of our consciences to meet a world emergency, is this really what we are? Can we really be entrusted by a gracious God of human destiny to point humanity to the promised land of which the ancient prophets prayed and the angels have sung? Or have we begun to develop among ourselves a mass hysteria which could well make of the struggles of humanity nothing other than the Shakespearean cynicism that day by day we ripe and ripe and day by day we rot and rot and thereby hangs the tale? Indeed, our present emotional atmosphere is certainly not conducive to the emergence of faultless prophets. A tragic and explosive paradox in world affairs today is that we probably, as Americans, may not be meeting, as we should, the need of the social forces of the world for a unifying and a regulating concept, as the wayward movements of these social forces threaten the scheme of things to which we are accustomed and to which we have been accustomed. We do not present always a calm faith in the identity of our struggle, of our structure, with history's long cherished ambitions and aspirations. We are in danger of developing instead a hysteria that spends much of its energies in thought control movements, in the feverish efforts to convince ourselves that we are all right just as we are. We too often refuse to face our social evils with public candidness. We have caricatured the so-called liberal off the face of our social and political map. We have become so smug in our self-righteousness that we refuse to make vigorous and forthright steps to guarantee basic civil rights to all our citizens and thus show the anxious world that we aspire to real leadership in world morality. Once considered the greatest revolutionists among the world's peoples, we now seem to be coveting the role of evolutionists. In particular, we have developed nationwide a totally uncritical acceptance, of every kind of improbable dishonor that may be charged against Russians and the framers of communist philosophy. Indeed, the food for our hysteria in this day is the fear of Russia and communism. Lest we forget that whom the gods destroy, they first make mad. Suppose we refresh our memory upon what Archibald MacLeish wrote in the August 1949 issue of the Atlantic Monthly under the title The Conquest of America. With your indulgence, I'll quote it. Sometime along in the 1980s, when the world has left us far behind as we have left the years that followed the First World War, somebody is going to publish a piece called The Late 40s. I hope to be dead at that time. That's Archibald MacLeish talking. The subject of this piece will be the conquest of the United States by the Russians. It will begin more or less as follows. Never in the history of the world was one people as completely dominated intellectually and morally by another people as the United States by the people of Russia in the 4 years from 1946 to 1949, and he might have brought it up to 1952. American foreign policy was a mirror image of Russian foreign policy. Whatever the Russians did, we did in reverse. American domestic politics was conducted under a kind of upside-down Russian veto. No man could be elected to public office unless he was on record as detesting the Russians. And no proposal could be enacted from a peace plan at one end to a military budget at the other unless it could be demonstrated that the Russians wouldn't like it. American political controversy was controversy sung to the Russian tune. Left-wing movements attacked right-wing movements too often not on American issues, but on Russian issues, and right-wing movements replied with the same arguments turned round about. American education was Russian education backward. Ignorance of communism was a principal educational objective recognized by politicians in the general press, and the first qualification demanded of a teacher was that he should not be a communist himself, should not have met persons who might have been communists, and should never have read books which could tell him what communism was. American intellectual life revolved around Russian intellectual life. Writers stopped writing and convoked enormous meetings in expensive hotels to talk about Russia for days at a time, with the result that the problems of American culture, if that self-conscious and over-fingered word is still in use in 1980, became reflections of the problems of Russian culture. Even religious dogma was Russian dogma turned about. The first duty of a good Christian in the United States in those years was not to love his enemies, but to hate the communists. After which he was told to pray for them if he could. End quote. Mr. MacLeish, in beautiful poetic prose, brings a warning to us that thinking men dare not ignore. But few men in public life today, in 1952, dare such a candid examination of these facets of our hysteria as Mr. MacLeish did 3 years ago. The public is jittery. We are frantic with fear. And we want no part of anything new. It is not a healthy, courageous, positive faith which we offer to the world today. It is an uncertain and jittery negativism. Indeed, some of us would go so far as to suggest that in the realm of interacting social forces, we have made all of the discoveries. We are paragons of virtue. There are no more frontiers ahead of us. Now, despite his pride in the historical greatness of our nation, no honest scientist can forego a warning against such a diseased state of mind. I am reminded, indeed, of the scientist who many years ago ventured the statement that all of the great discoveries of science had been made, all of the great fundamental discoveries, that it only remained for man to polish them and refine them and adapt them to our needs. That man had reached the zenith of his capacity to explore the fundamental unknown. And almost as if God himself had been angered by such arrogant skepticism, there descended upon this pronouncement an avalanche of the most glorious discoveries that have ever been credited to the human intellect. For hardly had the ink dried upon the words of this particular scientist before Michael Faraday drew a living spark from the lifeless magnet. And Daniel, Grove, and Bunsen, following close upon the heels of Faraday's discovery, gave us an enduring source of electrodynamic power, lifting, as it might be said, the burdens of the ages from the backs of man. An Ohm in Germany taught us how to measure such a power when obtained. In another field almost bordering upon the aesthetic, just after this scientist had written his words of skepticism, Bessel detected the parallaxes of the fixed stars. And scientific history recalls that Adams and Le Verrier threw their grapples out into space and felt the influence of an unseen planet, as Herschel puts it, trembling along the delicate lines of their analyses. Draper, de Geer, and Talbot revealed just about this time the wonders of actinism. And in another field which touches our hearts, Agassiz in Italy rode down the Alps upon the backs of the glaciers and proved their steady flow. And Darwin lifted the veil from the mysteries of organic development. And when I think of what this, how this scientist thought that we were all self-sufficient in even our own fields, I like to think of Stokes, as the legend puts it, as he stood one evening in his English country, in his garden in the English countryside, and gazed at a rainbow, as one of the chemical the stories in physics puts it. And as he gazed at the rainbow from the red to the violet end, he wondered what became of yonder violet as it faded into the invisible. And with this dream, Stokes had unwittingly discovered for us the ultraviolet, beyond the violet, and unwittingly blessed us with the coming of the sunshine vitamin, vitamin D, so that today we need no longer fear that our children may grow up with the crooked bones of rickets. So that today, stimulated by that discovery, stimulated by the discoveries that came as a result of the discovery of the ultraviolet, we have struck deep at the roots of arthritis and rheumatism. And so that today, they tell us, a hen that used to lay us 150 eggs a year now lays us 250 eggs a year because of DuPont's Delsterol. All because Stokes gazed at a rainbow? No, because in gazing at the rainbow, he had the courage to dream of better things in the days yet to come. And in our own country, hardly had the skeptic written his words before Thomas Edison made a discovery. As a matter of fact, Professor Duane of Harvard used to say that it was one of the only discoveries, that fundamental discoveries that Thomas Edison ever made. He's credited with hundreds of inventions, but one great fundamental discovery he made, according to Duane, that hot bodies give off electricity. Yes, when you heat a body to high temperature, found Edison, it gives off electricity, fast-moving electrons. And with this discovery, Edison had really written the first chapter in the history of the atom bomb, though insignificant a chapter as it might have been. And when Röntgen in Germany, also just after the skeptic had written these words of our self-sufficiency in science, when Röntgen in Germany read of Edison's discovery, he took a piece of tungsten metal and another piece of tungsten metal in a vacuum tube, as you know, heated the one which gave off the electricity of Edison. These fast-moving electrons bombarded the other piece of tungsten, and when Röntgen looked at it, he saw peculiar radiations. And lo and behold, what had Röntgen found? He had enlarged our vision with the X-ray, enabling our eye to see where hitherto we had not dreamed it would. And when Becquerel in France read of Röntgen's discovery, he decided to look at his uranium from a new point of view. Yes, this uranium which Becquerel had, known to science, mark you very carefully, primarily because a poor Russian lad, or partly at least because a poor Russian lad, Mendeleev, had struggled up through the university and out of the brilliance of his intellect had harnessed the wayward masses of the atoms into a system of periodicity, leaving a blank space which one day uranium was to fill. And now Becquerel had it. He wrapped it up in a piece of black paper, wrapped a photographic plate up in a piece of black paper, and put the two near one another. And when in a few hours he opened up the photographic plate, it was as black as if it had been exposed to the direct rays of the sun. And Becquerel had written a second and a very significant chapter in the history of the atom bomb. And when Marie and Pierre Curie read of Becquerel's discovery, Marie Curie knew where to go and look for her radium, and she went straight to that pitchblende from the passes of mountainous Czechoslovakia, and there she found it and gave to science, to humanity, not only the first remedy, concrete remedy against the malady of cancer, but gave to us a whole new science of protons, electrons, and alpha particles, so-called. And Marie and Pierre Curie had written a third and a very significant chapter in the history of the atom bomb. And Rutherford in England, again, just after the years when the skeptic had written these words, read of the Curie's discovery, and he bombarded an atom of nitrogen, and he split it into an atom of with alpha particles, and split it into into hydrogen and oxygen. And Becquerel had written a fourth chapter in the history of the atom bomb. And the years roll on, and Marie Curie's own daughter, Irene Curie, appears upon the scene with eyes, thanks to the courage of the investigators who had plotted on, not recognizing self-sufficiency, with eyes more highly trained by her mother, experience which taught her that coming off from this uranium and radium were not only particles charged with electricity, subject to the electromagnetic deflections of Faraday and of Daniel and Grove and Bunsen, but particles which went straight to their target, neutrons.